candid conversations that might just change how you look at the world. Let's bridge cultures, transcend borders, and build a global family of changemakers. Welcome to If by Chance.
No relationship is perfect, but in this conversation, Stephanie shares her story of marrying not one, but two narcissists. What lengths will a narcissist go to? And what should you do to avoid the same fate?
I'm originally from Oregon and I grew up here. I went to law school in Michigan, and my background is in domestic violence. So, you know, I was married to two narcissists. I spent 17 years within these two marriages. And at the same time, I was a leading expert on domestic violence, but I did not know I was actually in these abusive marriages because it doesn't always look like traditional domestic violence. And so many of us, we find ourselves in these relationships and they don't fit the mold of what we think of domestic violence. Like, well, they're a cheater, they're this, they're that, and this. And it took me stepping outside of those marriages to really see what was going on.
So can you describe a little bit more of that for
me? Yeah.
How did you come to the realization that they were narcissistic?
Yeah. And with my first marriage, we were married for almost 14 years. And I didn't really, he was like my first real boyfriend. I was older, like in my 20s. And I actually had just moved back to the States from South Africa and re-met him. We had always been in touch and stuff. Our parents knew each other. We both come from really, really great families. And so I didn't notice anything different except for my friends would tell me, man, your boyfriend puts you on a pedestal. He is always like love bombing you, all these things. Well, but you know, that was like my first relationship. So I didn't have, aside from my parents who modeled a very healthy relationship, so I didn't know that there was anything wrong. Then when I went off to law school, we got married, and all of a sudden, like all my attention that I normally would focus on him, validating him, loving him, fawning over him, all those things that sometimes you do in the beginning, all my focus was on law school. And when all my focus was away from him, he looked for validation, love, affirmation, all those things from other women. And so I found out he was cheating on me, but I had no idea because I was so busy living my life and doing that. And then the cheating just continued for 14 years. And so for me, I never really looked at that as abuse because he wasn't physically violent. Towards the end, it was more like the psychological, emotional abuse, definitely, for sure. But I had, okay, he's just a cheater. I don't know exactly what he did. You know, at some point we both just started living our kind of separate lives. I focused on kids and being a good mom and raising the kids. And he just never stopped. And so it didn't matter who it was either. And that's, you know, I think a lot of us who are in these toxic relationships, we think, oh, well, they're just looking for super hot, attractive people or this and that. It wasn't like that at all. It was just anyone that would give him the validation, the affirmations, the adoration that he was looking for.
Can we go back to love bombing? Yeah. So what is that? What does that look like?
So when someone is love bombing you, well, first let me back up just even a little bit more and I'll explain the cycle of narcissistic abuse. It is very similar to the domestic violence cycle, but a little different as well. So the cycle for narcissistic abuse is the beginning is the idolization stage. This is where they take you and put you on this pedestal. In this stage, they are telling you all these wonderful things about you, things that you want to hear. It feels good to hear this. You are so beautiful. I have been praying for God for you, and here you are. You are my soulmate. You are the most amazing person in the world. I love that you're a strong, independent woman. I love that you've done all these things with your life. I love that you've traveled all over the world. I loved that you're a lawyer. I love all your friends. Your friend, your girlfriends are so amazing. They're all strong, independent women. I love all this. And really what they are doing is they are mirroring you. And so it's everything, like you really feel like you are falling in love with the most perfect person.
I would have thought everybody would think, oh, I found my perfect person.
Yes.
Here. They're really acknowledging me. They're really seeing me for who I am.
Absolutely.
So how can you know when somebody compliments you versus somebody's love bombing you? Can you tell the difference?
You can. It's very subtle. So one of the things that both of my ex-husbands did was it was constant. They would constantly blow up my phone, constantly wanting my attention. And you can see in healthy relationships, you still have friends outside of that person. They don't call you all day long or text you all day long. And so I think if someone is starting to do all of that and also starting to get like telling you they love you or you're my soulmate, I mean, these are all big red flags in the early stages. You know, my second husband, I manifested him. I wrote out a list. I thought I was healed from my first marriage. It had been a couple of years. And so when I was like, okay, I'm ready to date, I made the list. I threw it out there to the universe. A week later, I met a man who checked off every single thing on the list. Divorced dad, only little boys, the same age as my little boys. A businessman, tall, dark, handsome. He had all the good looks that I had written down. He had everything. And so, you know, when he started saying, you're my soulmate, I manifested you. God brought you to me. I believe that because I legitimately prayed for him. But, you know, I like to say that in the universe and all God's greatness, I got exactly what I wanted, but I also got all the unlearned lessons. So you have the first stage is the idealization. And then the next stage is the devaluation. So a lot of times the devaluation stage might not happen until they know that you are hooked, till they know that they got you. And so for me, it really didn't happen until we got married. And it wasn't until right after we were married that his behavior changed. It was all the things he loved about me, he no longer loved about me. He hated all my girlfriends. He hated my profession. Oh, lawyers, this and that. And just always putting my profession down and what I did down. He turned into a different person. He said he didn't like country music. Then all of a sudden he's listening to country music. You know, it was like, wait a second. I married him and he completely turned into a different person.
So was he gaslighting
you? Oh yeah, there was so much gaslighting. And so what gaslighting is when they try to interfere with your perception of reality and of events and what happened. And so when the devaluation stage happened for me, it was during 2020. We got married in December 2019. March, the world shut down. And that's kind of when his behavior changed. So it was so confusing. I didn't know what was 2020 and what was his behavior. And so they take the gaslighting and just twist your words. Twist what you're trying to say and what you're trying to do. It becomes so confusing. And that's why they call it it's all under this umbrella of cognitive dissonance, because you don't really know what is reality and what is truth. So I started keeping a journal and I would say he has this a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality. I never knew which one was going to present itself. And you know, another example would be, say you're having a discussion or an argument and he would say, that didn't happen, or you're too sensitive. Oh, you're taking everything so personally. That's not what I meant. It becomes very confusing. So I stopped drinking because it was so confusing. And then I started journaling. And when I was completely present, I could say, no, this isn't right. Like, why is he saying all these things? That didn't happen. And that's what the gaslighting is. It's just a lot of manipulation, a lot of twisting the words. And so you have the idolization phase, then you have the devaluation. And so what happens after there's been a lot of gaslighting or criticisms or manipulation, then they'll come back and love bomb you again because they don't want you to leave. And they want to keep you confused because as long as you're confused, you're not going to leave them. And that's one of a lot of narcissists, it's one of their big fears is the betrayal, the abandonment, all that stuff. And so then they love bomb you again. And one of the things too with this cycle is a trauma bond forms when you have intermittent reinforcement of it's good, then it's bad, it's good. And even though it might be really bad, you know that good is going to come again.
And is it that with the love bombing, like I said before, it's like you feel like someone really understands you?
Oh, yeah.
Because they mirror you.
Oh, yeah, they mirror you. And in the beginning, they make it so easy for you to open up and talk to them. And so you're sharing all your vulnerabilities. You're sharing all your secrets. You're sharing all your insecurities. And when I got together with my second husband, he told me that his ex-wife cheated on him, which is not true, I have found out. But, so you have this like bond. Okay, we both know what it's like to be cheated on. And then I would share all my stories. And so he knew that one of my insecurities was this fear of continually being cheated on. And so when he would go into the devaluation stage, he would use that against me. And this is what narcissists do. They will use anything they can against you to hurt you. And so he would say, this girl called me and she wants me to go hang out with her. I don't really know her very well, but I'm thinking I might just go over and go hot tubbing or something. Like, who's a married husband says that? You know?
I'm not sure. But I just want to go back to your first husband for a sec. So you said he's cheated for 14 years.
During my middle of my second year of law school. And so I don't know if it was physical. It was physical towards the end when he left. It was a lot of emotional stuff. So what he would do, he would just chat with women all night online on Facebook. It didn't matter who. And in the beginning, I could see it all. I knew all his passwords.
This is 3 years or so into mm-hmm. your relationship.
Yeah, into our marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when were you aware that it had crossed that line and become physical?
I don't know. There were a couple times, like I used to go to Dubai every year. I worked in Dubai a couple times a year. And so when I was there, you know, there was a 12-hour difference. And I would still have this like, I need to check like his social media and all this stuff. And he would still constantly be chatting with women. And I would see messages like, hey, let's meet up or something. He has always denied everything. So I don't know. When he did leave for another woman, another married woman, and that was like the discard.
Yeah, I just asked that because I imagine that many people would be thinking, how could somebody stay knowing that their partner was cheating on them for such an extended period of time? But it sounds like you just didn't really have enough evidence to make a clear choice based on that.
But I would say an emotional affair, it's an affair. If you are talking inappropriately, sending pictures inappropriately, that's cheating, you know? And so there was still, there was the emotional affairs. And so I would bring it up and bring it up. and he just wouldn't stop. But it wasn't like it was every night. Or maybe it was. I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, I think maybe that was a while ago. It was a lot. And it never stopped. We had little babies, and I focused on our kids and raising our kids. And towards the end, it was more like we were roommates. There was barely any trust. And, you know, I've thought about this many times, like, Stephanie, why did you stay so long? And a lot of it was just my paradigm, the way I was brought up. You know, here I have my parents. They've been married for 45 years. His parents have been married for over 55 years. We had these families that, you know, you work things out. But then I have a husband who's not willing to work things out. And growing up in the church, it's like, well, you don't get a divorce. You don't do all this stuff. So I just kept it all to myself. Only a couple of my friends knew. And I just kept thinking, oh, maybe he will change. Maybe he will change. And he just never did change. And because they don't. They won't change unless they become aware and want to change. But it's very, it's like 0.001% will actually do the hard work and become aware and change. So, yeah, it took me a long time to work through that. Like, why didn't I leave? And those are the only answers I have. I stayed for my children. They were babies. And we had just built our second home that was, like, supposed to be the forever home. And I'm like, well, I have all my family around me. I have my girlfriends, you know. So I've done a lot of work to heal from that. And the lessons that you can take from these relationships, lessons, then you know what to heal and you know what to let go, what to release, so you can move on and break those patterns in your life.
So your second husband, you get married, his personality changes. We're in COVID. So you didn't have much contact with people outside of your relationship at that point?
That'd be right. No, except for my family. We all went on lockdown together. My sister just lived a couple houses down from us. And so it was like, okay, there's about three or four families, my parents and my other ex's parents and my sister. We kind of went on lockdown together. And but yeah, there was no one else.
Were you telling your sister what was going on?
Yeah. Yep. And my parents, they, you know, a couple times my parents would try to step in and say something, or they'd be like, Stephanie, the way he's talking to you and treating you is not right. And I'm like, I know, I don't understand why, because the other day he was so kind. Like, it was just so confusing. And how, when someone is so kind to you in the beginning, and then the devaluation, like I said earlier, is the cognitive dissonance. But on top of all of that, there's this word called the trauma bond. I don't know if you've heard of it or if your listeners have heard of it. So when you're in this cycle of intermittent reinforcement of going from love bombing to devaluation, it forms a trauma bond with this person. And the trauma bond is really hard to break. It's a lot like a drug addict and an addiction. So think of a drug addict, and the first time they use a drug, they get this really high dopamine release. And every time they use the drug after it, they never quite get that first high. So every time they use, it's a little less, it's a little less, it's a little yet less, but they keep using because they think maybe this will be the time that I will get that first high. So similarly with a trauma bond, you know that they know how to love you. You know that they know how to be kind to you and treat you with respect and treat you with kindness because they did all that in the beginning. And you're like, well, what do I need to fix about me to get back to that original first love?
So you feel like they're withholding
it from absolutely.
You because of something that you've done or not done.
Well, I mean, if you look at like a narcissist, it's a disordered personality. They may or may not be aware of what they're doing. I think that they are aware of what they're doing. It's just a game. It's a sick game. But, you know, it's that trauma bond that keeps you hooked and stuffed and what makes it difficult to leave. Because you think it was something that you did wrong, when really it has nothing to do with you. It's just their game. If that makes sense.
It does. You mentioned that you went into lockdown with your ex's parents. You've identified him as a narcissist. How do his parents feel about that?
His dad is a psychiatrist. I'm sure his dad is very aware of who his son is. My second husband, Josh, we'll just name them. It's easier than husband one and husband two.
Okay.
So Josh, my first husband, when he discarded me, his parents did not discard me. I've always been very close with them. I've always had a very close relationship with them. And Josh disowned his parents because they would not get rid of me. And they would not accept the woman that he had an affair with and ran off with. And so Josh's father is a psychiatrist and they are very aware of who he is. He has committed suicide and he is no longer with us, but his behavior and everything just got more intense and more tragic until he ended his life. Jace, my second husband, I don't know if his parents know, but they could see the pattern. I mean, he has had a physically abusive, aggressive relationship with his former wife and with every girlfriend he's ever had. So whether they know he's a narcissist, I do not know. I've had to cut his whole family off for my protection. But they know that there's domestic violence. They know that he's not a good person.
So you're saying that he was physically aggressive
my second husband, yes. Our marriage ended in physical violence when I told him I was leaving.
And how did you feel having had experience in the domestic violence space? I'm asking that because we hear, I don't know if I want to call it victim blaming, but we hear of people like, you know, how did you get yourself into this situation? And so I'm very interested because you're obviously highly educated.
Yeah.
And you have had a lot of exposure to domestic violence situations, I guess you could say. And you've probably seen people who, I imagine, the same sort of trauma bonds.
Oh, yeah.
In the domestic violence space.
I remember it was so frustrating working with victims of domestic violence because, you know, I would show up and interview them and then they would recant everything. And it was so hard to prosecute cases of domestic violence when you have an uncooperative victim and then you have the abuser who is trying to get the victim to change their story. And I see it differently now because of the trauma bond and the love bombing and all of this stuff. For me, I didn't know I was in like a domestic violence marriage because, again, it's a lot of the emotional, the psychological stuff. And he really became physically violent when I told him I was leaving. And that is also very true with domestic violence. It's when you're trying to leave is when it becomes the most violent or the hardest. If you're in an emotional or psychologically abusive relationship, with all the gaslighting, the manipulation, the love bombing, you know, all this stuff, it's very confusing. It's like, okay, well, maybe they're just having a bad day. And so you justify their behavior. But when you step back and take a look and look at everything in the totality, it's like, no, this is a very toxic, abusive relationship that you're in.
Having been through all of that now, do you feel that you can draw a clear line under what behavior is acceptable or not acceptable? Or do you feel that it's more of a zone?
It's, you know, I would say it's more of a zone, but it's a line for you. So going back to the lessons, for a very long time, I was stuck in this victim mindset. Like, oh, why does all this stuff keep happening to me? You know, I thought I found my forever person again, and he turns out to be just as bad, if not worse, than my first husband. And so for a long time, I was like, why me? Why me? I didn't do anything wrong. I'm a good person. I was a good wife. I'm a good mother. All these things. And I was sitting on the floor of my sister's house, just crying, God, why is all this stuff happening to me? And I really felt in that moment, God was saying, Stephanie, you're not seeing your story through the right lens. You need to be the hero of your story, the heroine, the star, not the victim of your story. Because when we're stuck in that victim mindset, we're actually giving them the power, not us. And so when I was able to just make that shift, instead of seeing these two ex-husbands as monsters trying to destroy my life, I could see them as teachers. And when I was able to see them as teachers, then I could see the lessons. Then I could sit down and say, thank you, Josh, for showing me that I need boundaries. Now, I didn't have boundaries for me, but I had boundaries for him. And how many of us have boundaries for other people?
I'm not even sure I know what
okay,
that means.
Okay, so let me explain. So you're in a relationship and this person is chatting with women online. And he's not stopping. So my boundary would have been, okay, if you continue that, I'm out. Instead, because he didn't have any boundaries or respect me, I would go and confront the other women. Do you know he's married? So in a sense, I was policing his boundaries, putting up boundaries for him. But we can't do that. We can only have boundaries for ourselves. And so when I went into my second marriage, I had boundaries. But he kept pushing, subtly pushing up against my boundaries. And I would take my boundaries and I would move it over here. Well, it wasn't a boundaries. It was like a toddler gate that I just kept moving and moving. That's not a boundary. And so, you know, I would say, you need to know what your boundaries are. You need to know what you're willing to put up with, what you're willing to tolerate, and what you're going to do if your boundary is crossed. And it needs to be a firm line boundary for you, not a toddler gate, not a little puppy gate.
That seems really difficult to do if you haven't experienced where relationships can come off the rails. Do you have any advice when it comes to setting those boundaries? Like, I imagine if we think about what could go wrong, it might not just be in terms of cheating, but it might be in terms of money or your reputation or, you know, what kind of areas do you think people should be setting boundaries for themselves?
Well, I think that people should be setting boundaries in all those areas. But when you are first meeting someone, you need to be a healed, whole person yourself.
So what strikes me is that you mentioned you came from a great family. So I wouldn't have thought that there was too much healing that needed to be done before you got into that first relationship.
Well,
would I be right in
saying
that?
So what I have learned, so yeah, I was a healed person, a whole person going into my first marriage, dating him. One of the big myths is that If you're with a narcissist or you're in an abusive relationship, there must have been some childhood trauma in your past. There wasn't. I come from a very, very healthy, strong family.
I'm just wondering, how can we know if we're vulnerable to this kind of thing? And is that what makes it more possible for narcissists to get a hold of a person? Are they looking for particular characteristics?
You know, I ask myself this question a lot as well, because, you know, here I was in two marriages. I don't want a third. I don't. But I will say, when you learn the lessons, when you do the healing, you break patterns. And so for me, I can say I don't have any fear going into another relationship. I have really done the hard work. You really, really have to switch your mindset. You need to not be the victim in your story. And so if we're constantly like, oh, I'm not going to date because it's going to be a narcissist, all this stuff, blah, 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 we might just attract that to us. Does that make sense?
So we're on a, let's just imagine it does. Let's just imagine we're on a first date. Tell me two or three things that you know now that would indicate to you that you should not go on a second date.
Well, if we've made it to the dating, first, I would do a background check. I do a background check on everyone. I do not even give my phone number out to someone. I will take their phone number and then I will go do run a background check on them. I do a background check on everyone.
So you're not on the apps?
No, well, I am, but I'm not really putting myself out there. But, you know, I mean, I'm human. I want to look. I want to see what's out there. I just have not really had any desire to date. So I would listen to the way they talk about women for me. What are they saying about women? What are they saying about their mom? What are they saying about their sisters and their aunts? This was something that my ex started saying all the time, like, oh, women always have it so easy. Oh, women are just all the victims and can manipulate the court and all of this stuff. And so if there is negative talk about women or their mother or their sisters, that's a red flag for me. Because it means that they don't value and respect women if they are saying stuff like that.
Do you have a couple of questions that you might ask to draw this kind of information out of people?
I would ask about their exes. So what were your past relationships like? Tell me about your family. Are you close to your family? Do you hang out with your family? Do you talk to your family? Because a lot of times they're not that close to their family. And like I said, it's, you hear a lot of the negative talk about women. So I would ask, what's your relationship with like with your parents? What is your relationship like with your siblings? How do you feel about women in politics or a woman being president? How do you feel about that? You know, just kind of casually. But if you start to pay attention, you can hear how they talk about women. And you can hear if it is, if they devalue or if they respect. And so for me, that's where I take the conversations.
And would you expect to see some love bombing behavior on a first date?
I think if for a first date, I'm imagining that you've had a couple conversations before the first date. And so I think if it's just too good to be true, you know, when they say like there's a big sale going on or this and that on the online, and it's like, if it's too good to be true, it's probably a scam. And so I think if they are just over the top complimenting you, just wanting to talk all the time, like I was saying before, if you start telling them something like, say, you know, one of my dreams was to sail around the world on a sailboat. Not many people have that. But for some reason, my second husband, that was number one on his bucket list too. So okay. I don't know. I think that if it's, and maybe this is just me being more of a skeptic, but too much too soon is too much.
Yeah. And do you think it could go either way after the first date in that they'll give you the cold shoulder because they've been so amazing on the first date? They want to make you want it, or do they just crowd you?
I think it's
both.
I do, because it's they want to see how you would react. Would you come crying back to them like, oh no, like fawning over them, or asking for an apology or whatever? Like, say you go out and it's your second date and maybe you drink too much and I don't know, something happens. And the next morning, is it you apologizing or are they apologizing? Look at how they, do they apologize? Like, it's so hard, it's because sometimes it's just so subtle, but yet it's not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what about friends?
Yes.
What about their
friends? Yes, absolutely. Who are their friends? Get to know their friends. My ex-husband didn't have any friends. That should have been a red flag. My first one had some childhood friends and stuff, but my second husband, he didn't have any friends. Right? That should have been a red flag. He had one friend, and his one friend passed away, and not from COVID, but in 2020. And so, yeah, I would do all of that, all the research, talk to the ex-wives, talk to the ex-girlfriends. So many of us, we have this fear of, oh, we can't talk to the exes. Talk to the exes. I went and talked to my second husband's ex-wife, and it was just very validating. And there's this book called Why'd He Do That by Lundy Bancroft. I don't know if you've heard of the book, but Lundy worked with abusive men for over 30 years. He's a therapist, and he's written all these books, and it's basically, they're not going to change. This is how they are. You know, move on with your life. But one of the things that he always says, and even when the men are in therapy saying that they are changing and talking to their wives, he'd call up all the wives. He'd call up all the girlfriends and talk to them. And he even says it. He's like, talk to the wives and the ex-girlfriends.
Can we talk about your children?
Yeah.
I would love to hear a little bit about their experience.
So with my first husband, Josh, I have two children. And with my second husband, Jason, we have a child together. With Jason, our child is a baby, so he's 2.5. But I will say with my older kids, I have always been very open and honest with them. This is your dad's behavior. This is why he's doing this. I always talked on their level, but I never hid it from them, because the reality is our children know a lot more than we think they know. So my second husband, one of his big things as well was toxic masculinity. And so if one of the boys did something and it didn't fit his model or ideal of masculinity, then he would shame them. And then I would go to the boys and say, hey, I saw that. I heard that was not right. That was not okay. And so my kids do have this awareness, which is, you know, when their father committed suicide 2 months ago. And when I sat down and told the boys what happened, a couple hours later, my 9-year-old said, Mom, we can go travel the world now. And that was his way of expressing that we are free. We are now in control of our life. We have no one controlling us or manipulating us. Although, you know, we were divorced for many years, there's still a lot of that post-separation abuse, using the legal system and using all other things.
I'm sorry for your loss. I'm not sure how you feel it, but that's so recent. It must be so raw, and especially for your boys.
Yeah, you know, there were so many mixed emotions there. I have forgiven him and moved on with my life. He was very toxic, obviously. He had his internal struggles for him to go that route. But with my kids, like I was saying, we have been healing and working through all of that. They know how to work through their emotions. I mean, you know, with guidance. And so that's one of the reasons right now I'm just doing podcasts is because I'm not working with people right now because I need to hold space for them. But because I was always open and honest with them at their level, they're not a mess. And same with me. And I think it's because I've had really good support systems and I've had a lot of tools to work through these things.
I think that's so fantastic that you've treated your children with that respect and recognizing them as little people who are very aware, so that now as they go through this with you, it's not going to be as shocking as it would have been otherwise.
Absolutely. And again, for my 9-year-old to say, "Mom, let's go travel the world now." I mean, your dad just died, and that's what he's saying. It is, they knew. And, you know, I'm not trying to paint their father in a bad light. In fact, I've done a lot of things to encourage healing. I bring him up every time I can. "Oh, your dad loved that." Like, I don't want them to feel like they cannot talk about their dad. And I do a lot of meditation and stuff. And so I've found some guided meditations where you can actually, we do it at night when they're in bed. So we're family bed style right now. But I'll put on this one guided meditation that you meet a loved one who's passed on, and you can go and spend time with that loved one and connect and stuff.
Are you very forward looking at this time? Do you have any plans for the next 6 months or?
Yeah, I am sharing my story and getting it out there. I'm working on a couple books right now on victim mindset and also a couple different books on narcissism, because both my husbands were narcissists, but they were both very different types. And so I'm doing that. And me and the boys, we are planning a trip to Portugal, and we are all studying Portuguese right now. So that's kind of fun because I think we're on day 45. We're on that Duolingo app. So that's kind of our big thing. My kids are really into soccer, which is why they want to go to Portugal, because Cristiano Ronaldo is a soccer player from there. And so we're like, well, let's just go. You know, in the beginning, I was telling you about my travels and stuff. And one of the things I always wanted to do was just go travel around the world with my kids and world school and take some time off. So I think we're going to go do that for a little bit. That's kind of the plan.
That sounds amazing. Are there any last thoughts that you want to leave us with?
Yeah. One of the big ones is we all have the keys to healing within us. We just might not have the right tools. And if you've been in a toxic relationship or a relationship with another, so many healing modalities out there. For me, I journal, I do breath work, I do meditation and mindfulness, and I do EFT. And it just so happens that one of my very best friends is a licensed family therapist. But so many, I have found from talking to so many people, they think that their only option is talk therapy, psychotherapy. But there are so many different modalities out there. And all of these, try them all. See what resonates, what works for you. Because this ending a relationship with a narcissist or an abuser is very different from ending a relationship with a healthy person. It's not the same breakup. Time does not heal. So if you do not do anything, you are just going to sit there and remain for years. Time does not heal. You have to break the trauma bond. You have to do the hard work. You have to see the lessons. You need to know what you need to heal, what you need to release and let go, because that is the only way you will be able to move forward in a healthy way, is doing the hard work.
Most of us haven't undergone relationship training, and most of us don't understand why people in toxic relationships stay. This conversation was illuminating on a subject that many people are uncomfortable discussing. If you found it helpful, please share this episode with someone in your life so they can create a positive relationship instead of a toxic one.
Now, dear listener, it's your turn. Have you got something to add to the conversation? Then get in touch via the links in the show notes. Whether you have questions, a message of support, or resources that you think might help, we'd love to hear from you. And if by chance you know someone with a story that will inspire others, be sure to let us know. Your contributions help turn inspiration into action, drive positive change, and make life just that little bit better. And if this conversation inspired you to expand your worldview, head to hellohuman.global to join the conversation.